Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated January 4th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Welcome to 2013, and this year's first edition of the Triangle Business Journal has a series of articles entitled 10 People to Watch in 2013. We'll get to that in a moment. Today's lead article is Redmond Takes Trademark Independent by Amanda Jones Hoyle. This article is from Raleigh. One of the Triangle's largest commercial real estate firms, Trademark Properties, is dropping its national affiliation with the Coldwell Banker Commercial Network to become, once again, an independent regional brokerage group. Raleigh-based Trademark Properties began using signs with its new name and new logo on December 31st after its 10-year franchise agreement with Coldwell Banker Commercial expired, says Trademark Properties' longtime CEO, Billy Redmond. Trademark Properties had been one of CBC's elite-level brokerage firms, ranking among its top 15 revenue-generating affiliates in the country. But Redmond says her leadership team decided after much deliberation that the Trademark Properties brand was strong enough to stand on its own. "I think our industry has forever changed after the recession," Redmond says. "We can obtain real-time information and make decisions in a completely different way than we could 10 years ago." Redmond notes also that Trademark has created its own network of 250 brokers across the southeastern U.S. through its Special Asset Solutions division that was started in 2008. The division was formed to help national, regional, and community banks manage their portfolios of foreclosed properties. It has helped sell more than $100 million each year in bank-owned property assets in Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, Texas, and six other states. "We were working in markets that we still don't know where they are," Redmond says, "and I realized that everywhere where I went, it was local, local, local. Eat local, shop local. We realized that local is where we need to leverage our business." Mike Lipsky, president of the Altamont Springs, Florida-based commercial real estate training and consulting firm, The Lipsky Company, says he's answering at least a call every week from a regional real estate firm whose executives are trying to decide whether to renew as an affiliate with a national firm or go independent. "We're seeing more people go through that decision-making process more in the last 90 days than we have seen in the last 5 or 6 years," he says. "A prime factor to consider," he says, "is psychological. They don't want to feel like they are in a big boat in a big ocean all by themselves. Then there's the monetary factor that must be evaluated. How many referrals have come in as a result of this relationship, and what did it cost to get that business? If it's not close at all, then that's when they tend to drop the brand," he says. Lipsy notes that a commercial real estate firm in a major market such as Los Angeles or Chicago would likely benefit the most by affiliating with a national real estate network because it's easy to get lost in the shuffle of competitors. But in a smaller market like Raleigh, the people driving around already know the region and they know the players. Everyone already knows everyone. That sentiment was echoed by John Powell, who Trademark Properties recently hired as executive vice president. Powell, for 20 years, owned and operated his own Cary-based real estate firm, Powell Properties, and had also tried the franchising model after aligning his company with KW Commercial in 2010. "They were mighty good to me, but I also felt like I might not be maximizing the talents I felt like I had," Powell says. "People do business with people they like and with people they trust. Lots of times it's not where you hang your hat, as long as you hang your hat with a solid, reputable company." Redmond has hinted at more expansion opportunities for the 28-year-old company in 2013, including recruitment of more talent, the addition of offices in North Carolina, and additions to its service offerings once a pending acquisition is finalized. Trademark Properties, as of January 2nd, had 26 brokers on staff, with a total staff of 82 people, ranking it as the largest commercial brokerage firm in the Triangle, according to the Triangle Business Journal research. Moving inside, Windstream Cementing Triangle Presence by Lauren K. Onisores from Raleigh. 2 years after acquiring Raleigh-based Hosted Solutions for $310 million, Little Rock, Arkansas-based telecom Windstream Corporation is upping its Triangle stake by adding a data center in Durham. Kip Turco, local site lead and senior vice president of data center operations, says Windstream's local headcount has grown since the 2010 acquisition and now stands just shy of 200. Turco, who came to the company from Hosted Solutions, where he served as the chief operating officer, says the company has transformed a ton since 2010. If you roll back to 2010, we were primarily in 3 markets and 5 data centers with 1 cloud computing pod, he says. And today, we're in 23 data centers, multiple markets, and comparing 2010 versus today from a business standpoint, we've doubled our revenue. We're growing like gangbusters. And the growth isn't random. Hosted's founder, Rich Lee, says Windstream's success can be traced to a move by the company to focus its future on where the market was going rather than where Windstream had been heading. A lot of telecom companies are buying up a lot of data center companies because they recognize that's where a lot of the growth is going to come from. A lot of that old traditional legacy landline business is going backwards in terms of revenue. For Lee, timing was everything in his decision to sell Hosted. Verizon and CenturyLink were making big purchases, and it was only a matter of time before Hosted got its own suitor. They all decided they wanted to be in the business, and that's always a pretty good time to sell, he says. So sell he did. Now they've expanded into a lot of new markets. With their balance sheet behind them, he says, they've grown at a much faster rate than our internal capital could have done. And as part of the strategy, Windstream kept most of Hosted's then 125 employees. A much different story from other highly touted acquisitions, such as that of Beltsville, Maryland-based Vocus acquisition of Morrisville company iContact, a move that meant 75 layoffs. It was a very complimentary acquisition to Windstream, Lee says of Hosted, which had reported $51.7 million in sales in the last quarter before the acquisition. Windstream had total reported revenue of 2012 in $1.6 billion. As for the newly announced and impending data center, while a minimal staff will oversee the site, the real job growth will come in the form of support employees. Additional data centers built elsewhere, including one announced earlier this month in Nashville, will also up the Triangle headcount. Where we're really growing is in our support structure for our managed services and cloud computing platform, Turco explains, and we have a centralized model where the majority of people who work on those teams work in the RTP area. Currently available are 30 positions, mostly high-paying technical engineering positions, he says. Windstream's acquisition of Rochester, New York-based Patek in 2012 further pumps up the need for RTP support, he adds. CEO Jeffrey Gardner mentioned Windstream's acquisition strategy to investors in a call announcing the company's third quarter results. Our targeted acquisition strategy has strengthened Windstream, he says. The Patek acquisition created a national footprint, which has improved our ability to win larger, multi-location business customers, build a first-class business sales organization with advanced solutions, expertise, and network capability, which are allowing us to gain market share and improve business revenues. Windstream went public in 2005 under the name Valor Communications Group and changed its name to Windstream in 2006 after acquiring the local telephone operations of Altel. In 2010, Windstream revenue was $3.7 billion. In 2011, revenue was $4.3 billion. Continuing inside, local recovery will top nation, and concludes a PNC. This article is by Lee Weisbecker, and it's from Raleigh. the creation of higher-wage tech and professional service jobs that help the triangle escape the worst of the downturn is expected to continue in 2013, bumping up by another 3.5% in the coming year. That's one of the conclusions of economists from PNC Financial in a new, highly localized forecast that takes in the Raleigh and Durham metros as well as the Goldsboro and Rocky Mount markets. The combined area makes up the bank's Raleigh market. The Raleigh market economic recovery is set to top the nation's recovery again in 2013, says Mikhail Teshom, the bank's assistant vice president. Raleigh and Durham metros will lead the pack as education, healthcare, tech, and professional services drive above-average payroll growth. With slightly less dynamic economic drivers working in their favor, the smaller metros of Goldsboro and Rocky Mount will likely expand at a slower pace, according to the forecast. Overall, PNC expects employment in the Raleigh market to grow by 2.1% in 2013, outpacing the expected national growth rate of 1.4%. The area's jobless rate at 8.7% last January dropped to 7.9% in October 2012 and is expected to decline further to 7.6% by the fourth quarter of 2013. The employment forecast, as well as the other parts of the PNC analysis, are based on some negotiated resolution of the current fiscal cliffs talk in Washington, says PNC economist Kurt Rankin. Had a solution not been reached, he believes a recession may have ensued. One recent drag on Triangle area employment has been public sector downsizing. Though the worst layoffs is over, government payrolls continue to be trimmed, as they have done so for the past few years, Teshom says. Besides jobs, the PNC forecast touches on a number of other areas, including housing, income, and demographics. On housing, expect to see prices of single-family homes rise by 2.4% in 2013, about on par with U.S. expectations. Single-family home sales are rising thanks to stronger jobs and income growth, according to the Raleigh market analysis. Locally, a family earning the median income can afford a house that is twice the median price. While the housing analysis takes in all of the bank's Raleigh market, by virtue of their sheer size, Raleigh and Durham dominate the findings, says Rankin. Meanwhile, new home construction, currently subdued, will stay that way throughout 2013, according to the forecast. However, it adds that a combination of factors, favorable demographics, stronger jobs and income growth, and high affordability will support housing demand and set the stage for prices to rise. On a personal income, expect to see a Raleigh market bounce of 4.7% next year, well ahead of the forecasted national growth rate of 3.9%. Local median income is already 5% higher than the national average, thanks to the high concentration of tech industries in Durham and Raleigh. Total personal income growth picked up the fourth quarter of 2012 after a hiccup in the fall, says PNC. Renewed job growth is lifting wage income. Over the long term, strong population growth will drive above-average total personal income growth. PNC, which rapidly expanded its southern presence earlier this year with the acquisition of Raleigh-based RBC Bank USA, is performing similar localized economic forecasts for most of its newly acquired locations, including Charlotte, Atlanta, and other areas. The current plan calls for the Raleigh market forecast to be released twice a year, says PNC spokeswoman Dorsey Landis Tobias. Continuing on, no worries. Sempra has cash to move pneumonia drug along. By Lauren K. Onisores. This article is from Chapel Hill. Chapel Hill drug development firm, Sempra Incorporated, is about to enter the phase 3 testing of its pneumonia treatment candidate, an expensive endeavor expected to cost the company $23 million. But no worries, says CEO Prabhu Fernandez. After all, it was funding that drug, dubbed Sirithromycin, that prompted the company to go public nearly a year ago. As of September 30th, Sempra reported cash and equivalents of about $51 million. Compare that to the end of the year pre-IPO cash stash in 2011 of December of $15 million, and it's clear why Fernandez calls the IPO the best thing we could have done. Indeed, we could have gotten a better valuation and waited, but I think being public gives us the flexibility to move forward and build value every day, she says. The company raised $50 million in that IPO, enough, she says, to undertake the pneumonia drug test and to go into phase two for a joint infection medication. Initially, the company had intended to sell 6 million shares priced in the $11 to $13 range, a move that could have raised up to $78 million. Instead, 8.4 million shares opened in February 2012 at $6 per share. Sempra primarily pushing two clinical stage compounds, the antibiotic pneumonia drug aimed at a community-acquired bacterial pneumonia, and a second antibiotic aimed for prosthetic joint infections. Both compounds are differentiated and both have huge potential. The pneumonia drug has a monotherapy potential, meaning a patient takes a single oral medication instead of the combination of therapies currently used. There are two types of pneumonia, hospital-acquired and community-acquired. Both involve pus filling the lungs, explains Joseph Misgert, director of the Pulmonary Center at the Boston University School of Medicine. But the two versions are typically caused by different bacteria, and Sempra is focusing on the community-acquired disease. The most common cause of community-acquired pneumonia is a bacteria called Streptococcus pneumonia, explains Misgert. Misgard, who is not associated with Sempra and is unfamiliar with the candidate, says there's a definite need for the new and innovative treatments, given the amount of antibiotic resistance that's percolating. Steve Brozark, analyst and president of WBB Securities, says no one disputes the fact that erythromycin will work. The question is, will it work on a large scale? He's optimistic. You've got a strong tailwind behind the product and the company, he says, calling erythromycin absolutely an essential drug. We don't have any backups, he says, and the current antibiotic shortage we have right now, if one bad bug breaks through, we're in really serious trouble. This particular drug is a microlide antibiotic and can bind to a second part of the bacteria, increasing potentially efficacy against antibiotic-resistant strains. When the Z-Pak, a similar agent, was branded, it was selling globally for $2.3 billion. If cleared, the singular therapy Sempra is developing is estimated to attack the $800 million U.S. market. Now it's time to roll up our sleeves, says Fernandez. Next up, in response to reform, Blue Cross Blue Shield adds less expensive policies, by Jason DeBrun from Chapel Hill. To serve small companies looking for more affordable health insurance, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina is offering two new group plans with premiums as much as 15% lower than the company's existing offerings. There are trade-offs in the form of higher deductibles and copays. In addition, the provider network of available doctors under the plans is smaller and ranked on a tiered system based on physicians who have a overall lower cost to Blue Cross Blue Shield North Carolina. The new plans are named Blue Value and Blue Select. Thorough market research, we've learned that a segment of consumers value price over a more traditional broad network of providers, says Brad Wilson, chief executive of Blue Cross Blue Shield North Carolina. These products appeal to these consumers. There are obvious benefits to businesses. Employers often share the cost of premiums, but not copays or deductibles. These plans afford employers a way to provide health insurance to employees at lower rates. Thanks to health reform signed by President Obama and upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, employers with 50 or more workers will be required to offer health insurance or pay a fine. The restaurant industry has particularly opposed that aspect of the law because it has a large number of low-wage employees. In fact, the minimum wage for tipped workers is significantly lower than for workers in other sectors. Dawn Sweeney, president and CEO of the National Restaurant Association in Washington, D.C., called the Supreme Court decisions to uphold the law troubling for restaurant operators. After learning of the new plans from Blue Cross Blue Shield North Carolina, Lynn Mingus, president and CEO of the North Carolina Restaurant and Lodging Association in Raleigh, seemed cautiously interested. Plans like this one bring new health insurance options into consideration, she says. Still, she did not see these new plans as a panacea. maintaining the viability of small businesses where labor costs already compromise over one-third of their overall cost will be challenging, she says. By limiting and tiering in-network doctors and practices, Blue Cross hopes to encourage patients to go to those practices that save money for everyone. In turn, it's hoped that will encourage other providers to reduce their cost. Other health insurers have a tiered system in various markets throughout the state, but this is the first statewide system, says Michael Parkerson, Blue Cross Blue Shield North Carolina Vice President of Marketing. This week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal features 10 people to watch in 2013. The TBJ has compiled a list of the top 10 people in the Triangle that they think are poised to have a big impact in 2013. This list contains new CEOs, green solar farmers, small business executives, and much more. And now, here are their dossiers. Melanie Dubas, from Parker Poe Adams and Bernstein, LLP. Proactive mentoring, a growing practice, and a handful of high-profile cases combined to make Parker Poe's Melanie Black Dubas an important person to watch in 2013. Dubas, a partner in the Charlotte-based firm's Raleigh office, handles a range of commercial and securities litigation. While most of her work is squarely in the private sector, she helped lead a team that in August won a major victory in a long series of lawsuits over public education in North Carolina. In a case brought by Dubas' team and schools in Asheville and Hope County, a Court of Appeals panel ruled 3-0 that school funding in the state's 2011 budget fell short of court rulings that guaranteed free preschool for at-risk 4-year-olds. The state appealed the ruling to the North Carolina Supreme Court. Because the lower court decision was unanimous, the high court can choose not to review it. Attorneys expect that decision within a couple of weeks. The litigation dates to the mid-1990s, as Dubas was graduating from Vanderbilt University's law school. Represented by Parker Poe partner Bob Spearman, families and school districts in Hoke and four other poor counties sued the state, arguing that the state was shortchanging their children's education in favor of students in wealthier counties. The Supreme Court sided with Spearman, Dubas, and the five counties in 1997 and 2004. It turns out that the Hoke County student, whose family was named as the lead plaintiff, Rob Leandro, went on to Duke University, graduated from Vandy Law in 2006, and has joined Dubas as a litigator at Parker Poe. It's been amazing to see the work they've done and what Melanie's done and how the case has evolved, Leandro says. Knowing the culture and the people like Melanie has a lot to do with why I'm working at Parker Poe. For her part, Dubas says she's benefited from mentoring by some of the finest litigators in the state, including former Associate Attorney General and Parker Poe partner, Catherine Arrowwood, and has made a point of passing what she's learned along to the next generation. I really try to focus on getting associates early on to take depositions, to argue motions, and to examine witnesses at trials, Dubas says. She points to a case pending in state court in which she is representing a plaintiff in a trade secrets case. She had an associate make the closing argument to the judge, who responded that it was a strong one, she says. In other litigation, Dubas has represented generic pharmaceutical manufacturers and a series of financial services firms, including large accounting firms. Her goal for the next couple of years is to continue developing her patent and trade secrets litigation practice. The next person to watch is Neil Fowler from Liquidia Technologies. Neil Fowler, CEO of Liquidia, had a great year in 2012 and is to be watched in 2013. His UNC Chapel Hill spinoff landed a huge deal with British drug maker GlaxoSmithKline, giving GSK exclusive rights to research and develop some of Liquidia's vaccine and inhaled product candidates. But, and this is important, Liquidia maintained the right to independently develop new candidates in certain areas. Together, we've taken our vaccine and pulmonary programs to another level, especially given GSK's experience, leadership, and expertise in these two arenas, Fowler says. But that's 2012. Why keep watching? It's because of what Liquidia is planning next. The company has the capital to look into other areas such as ophthalmology and oncology for deals. Early data suggests that we have a very exciting future in these areas, Fowler says. Put another way, expect partnerships to grow in number and in depth, he says. Our manufacturing capabilities will continue to grow in scale and sophistication in an effort to make Liquidia a world-class leader in unique nanoparticle design and production, he adds. Fowler isn't just a biotech leader. He represents an emerging industry that's becoming even more mainstream, nanotechnology. It's about utilizing tiny particles, technology that works at the molecular level. The applications aren't just in medicine. It's an area that's bringing jobs to North Carolina in applications ranging from filters, Xanafi, to vaccines, Liquidia. It's also an area where Fowler sees growth all around. Liquidia, which received the first Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation grant for biotechnology, is among companies leading the charge locally. The company, the community, is starting to pay attention. Earlier this year, the North Carolina Center of Innovation for Nanotechnology hosted a panel entitled, How to Build 54 New Liquidias. The number three person to watch in 2013. Paula Freiland from PNC Bank. Even before the official closing of PNC Bank's $3.45 billion purchase of Raleigh's RBC Bank USA, Paula Freiland was already meeting with Triangle community leaders and making her presence known here. As head of Eastern North Carolina and Raleigh operations for PNC, Freiland is just getting started in carrying out the bank's vision for the Triangle. Freiland oversees corporate and commercial banking in PNC's Triangle footprint, which includes 32 bank branches and about $4.8 billion in local deposits, making it the second largest area bank in terms of market share, according to the FDIC. Now established atop the downtown high-rise that once bore the RBC name, Freiland is looking to continue to expand PNC's presence in the Triangle. Though she declined to discuss specifics, Freiland says she's really anxious to grow in this market. We are going to continue to ramp up all efforts around growing our business very aggressively here going forward, Freiland says. The Triangle is one of the main keys to our successful expansion in the Southeast. Over the next 3 years, we expect to have double-digit growth in the Triangle. Freiland, a Rutgers graduate and 20-year veteran of PNC, says her immediate plans for the future include working with the bank's customers and building trust within the local market. And this permeates into local philanthropic efforts as well. Freiland says she's fully committed to beefing up PNC's local charitable efforts and adds that the bank is trying to find good partnerships on that front. This effort will build on what PNC is already doing. For example, in late June, PNC announced that in an initial round of corporate giving, it would split $1 million to support a pre-K arts program in Wake County schools and a workforce training effort in Rocky Mountain. PNC is committed to expanding its Triangle vision and building brand awareness locally, Freiland says, and she's busy positioning her team to do just that. Next up, Bob Giolis from the RTP Foundation. Since being named president and CEO of the Research Triangle Park Foundation in November 2011, Bob Giolis has been working to build something that captures the world's attention. Sounds like someone worth watching as we begin the new year. That something centers around one of the biggest announcements regarding the 7,000-acre Research Triangle Park in recent history. It's the revelation of a new master plan that aims to position the park for the future. Soon after his arrival, Giolis began working with the foundation's board on the implementation of the new RTP master plan. The plan revolves around repositioning the park to incorporate a more inclusive atmosphere in order to create an environment to better foster the exchange of ideas. Though the plan was already in the works when Giolis arrived on the scene, he says his focus is on developing the action plan for the 53-year-old research park. Giolis delivered objectives to his team on how he wanted to see the master plan developed, with the goal of providing a destination and feel for RTP that is very authentic and opens up more opportunities for collaborative partnerships. As good as that master plan is, we also need to make sure that it is relevant and connected to all the partners we have here, Giola says. We need something that links education and industry. That partnership development will be further submitted in 2013 as the foundation looks for project architects and other development partners. At the unveiling of the master plan, RTP officials took the first step in its implementation and picked Hines, a Houston-based real estate development and investment firm, as a partner in the first phase of the new development for a mixed-use center planned near the campuses of IBM and RTI International at Davis Drive and Cornwallis Road. Giolis predicts more of those partner announcements in 2013. The new RTP master plan is currently in the site development stage, and construction on the first phase is about 18 months out, Giola says. This year is mostly about getting more and more people to buy into new RTP and developing the necessary partnerships to create what Giola calls something big, global, and important. We are moving into an actionable plan for 2013, Giola says. Last year was a planning year. This year we are starting to make things happen. Number 5 in the top 10 list for those to watch in 2013 is Lawrence Lane from the Pulte Group, Incorporated. One of Lawrence Lane's top priorities when he took control of the Pulte Group's Raleigh Home Building Division in October 2010 was to find a suitable replacement for the company's hugely successful Carolina Preserve active adult community that was nearing sellout in Cary. Pulte's Del Webb branded communities have become the market leaders when it comes to communities built specifically for people ages 55 and older. When Carolina Preserve opened in 2006, it sold more than 100 homes in the first 10 days on the market. But because of their size and complexity, Del Webb communities can take several years to get approved and begin construction. Company-wide, Michigan-based Pulte Group was already focusing more on a better absorption pace rather than increasing its community count when Lane was transferred from Atlanta to Raleigh to take over the Raleigh division. But he also knew that when the last lots were sold at Carolina Preserve, the company's overall position as the region's largest home builder group could be in jeopardy. Pulte even acknowledged in October 2012 earnings report that Raleigh was the only division in the Southeast that wasn't increasing its net new orders for new homes. Homes built by Pulte in the Triangle have dropped by 36% from a peak of 875 new homes built in 2009 after completing a merger with Centex Homes to only 556 homes finished in 2011. Lane says the decline is largely because Carolina Preserve at Amberley is nearing final closeout with only about 50 lots left to sell out of the 1,200 home sites built within the community. Other builder groups that compete with Pulte in the Triangle have also become more aggressive in securing land positions that Pulte would have gone after in the past. But Lane is expecting 2013 to be a new year for Pulte in the Triangle. The company's second Del Webb active adult community, Carolina Arbors, is expected to open in February, and the Durham City Council approved Pulte's plan to build nearly 1,300 homes in a 434-acre parcel of land near Briar Creek in June. So far, Carolina Arbors is the only new Del Webb community that Pulte plans to open in 2013, and Lane says it couldn't be coming at a better time. Pulte CEO Richard J. Dugas noted in his third quarter conference call with analysts in October that the company is already starting to see a notable shift among potential buyers in the active adult communities. Number 6 is Jesse Lipson from Citrix ShareFile. When Jesse Lipson started ShareFile, it was basically a one-man operation. And now, more than 200 people work at the company in Raleigh. After being acquired by Santa Clara, California-based Citrix last year, the landscape started to change for the old ShareFile, not just in terms of having a new name, but also in its footprint. It was announced in 2012 that Citrix would relocate to downtown Raleigh's warehouse district and expand its operations with a $12.5 million investment. It's a move that Lipson hopes will invigorate the district, as the move of Red Hat from Centennial Campus to downtown Raleigh is doing in the Fayetteville Street area. Citrix, he hopes, will have a domino effect, bringing more companies and more culture to a community that he and his wife, local business owner Brooks Bell, call home. With new space comes new people. In addition to doubling its headcount in the past year, the headcount will keep ticking upwards when Citrix moves downtown. The renovated warehouse building Citrix intends to occupy has a capacity of 560 employees and the ability to add two floors to make that number top 800. The way the progress is going, it won't be too long before we have to expand, Lipson says. But that's not the only reason to watch Citrix and its Raleigh operations. I think that Citrix is in a good place, Lipson says, noting that as budgets consolidate, more and more people are seeing the benefits of working on the go, and that's a situation directly addressed by Citrix software. We are positioned really well to capitalize on this trend towards mobile. As for Lipson, he keeps the triangle plenty of reasons why to keep his eyes peeled. In addition to running Citrix local operations, he's one of the founders of Hub Raleigh, an open workspace giving entrepreneurs a cheap way to start their businesses. Pay attention. It's going to be a year of growth for this company in Raleigh. The move downtown happens in the fourth quarter of 2013. Number 7 of the 10 people to watch in 2013, according to the Triangle Business Journal, is Pat McCrory, the new North Carolina governor. In Charlotte, when he ran City Hall for 14 years, he became known simply as Mayor Pat. Come early January, the rest of the state will begin to be introduced to Patrick Lloyd Pat McCrory, the 53rd mayor of Charlotte, who will become the 74th governor of the state of North Carolina. He'll enter office with a wind at his back. According to Raleigh-based public policy polling, 53% of respondents in a December 12 sampling had a favorable opinion of McCrory compared to a 25% unfavorability rating. He's predictably very popular with Republicans, 82% to 8%, and independents, 50% to 31%. But what really makes his numbers impressive is that he comes close to breaking even with Democrats at 33% to 35%, says PPP's Tom Jensen. Meanwhile, the GOP-controlled General Assembly, with which Republican McCrory will work to fashion state policy, had only a 15% favorability rating in the same sample. The poll was taken before McCrory's most recent round of cabinet and staff appointments, a round that included the selection of conservative Raleigh businessman and sometimes lightning rod Art Pope as the governor's chief budget officer. But just who is our new governor? Here are a few basic facts. He was born October 17, 1956, in Columbus, Ohio. He got an early initiation into politics from his father, a city councilman in the small town of Worthington, Ohio. His favorite authors, as he has told one interviewer in Charlotte during the campaign, are George Orwell and World War II historian Stephen Ambrose, who wrote Band of Brothers. The CDs in his car at the time were Abbey Road by the Beatles and Who's Next by The Who. The three people with whom he'd most like to dine with are Bill Gates, Paul McCartney, and his nephew. Among the state's most influential political leaders, in his way of thinking, are three former governors, Republicans Jim Holzhauser and Jim Martin, and Democrat Jim Hunt. The most pressing issue facing the state? The budget deficit, including the billions of dollars borrowed from the federal government and various unfunded liabilities not carried on the books. Streamlining the apparatus of state government and making the state more business friendly. Pat McCrory, a former mayor of Charlotte and a Republican, will be North Carolina's next governor. Next up, Tom Pike from Quintiles Incorporated. It's most likely to be a milestone year for Quintiles Incorporated, the homegrown contract research organization that has become one of the world's largest organizations in that space. So why will 2013 be any different from recent years when this company has notched up double-digit revenue growth? Because in 2013, the general public once again may have a shot at owning a part of this company. When Dennis Gillings left his CEO's post last year, and the company's board announced that former Accenture manager Tom Pike would take over the helm, Gillings and his board basically gave away the intention of the company. It wants to be traded on Wall Street, preferably on the New York Stock Exchange. Pike will be the man to watch because it is his duty to expand the revenue and margins of the company. If the company wants to go with a blue-chip underwriter such as Goldman Sachs or J.P. Morgan Chase, the corporate finance guys want to be able to offer up a squeaky clean balance sheet. Give credit to Gillings for trying to empower his lieutenants in trying different things in the past two decades. Quintiles is a $3 billion-plus company because of that. But having all these peripheral ideas also cost money and took a toll on the margins. Pike's job at Quintiles is to make the company efficient, whether that means cleaning up the capital structure, money is cheap right now, or right-sizing the company. Folks at the Durham executive offices of Quintiles will never admit publicly that the company is reviewing each aspect of its business when it fits with Quintiles becoming public. Pike has acknowledged that the current focus of the company is growing organically. Given Quintiles' history, in which the majority of its revenue has come from abroad, the company will continue to grow overseas. Any weekday visit to one of the company's offices or social gatherings looks more like a UN gathering. Different colors, different languages, different cultures, but all working cohesively and together. Ask anyone in the corporate triangle and they would admit that Quintiles is a star in the region, and Gillings gets the credit for building this global company. But success in the private world and success in the public world are vastly different. In order to be successful in the public world, it is never what you have done in the past. It is always about what you will do for me, i.e. the shareholders, in the future. Number 9 in the top 10 people to watch in 2013, according to the Triangle Business Journal, is Marcus Wilhelm from Strata Solar, LLC. North Carolina's solar energy industry has been very much worth watching in the last half decade as a new law fostered the spread of glass and silicon across dozens of pastures statewide. Strata Solar, LLC of Chapel Hill has emerged as the industry's 200-megawatt gorilla, accounting for roughly half the solar generating capacity that is registered to go online in North Carolina in 2013. In fact, and the possibility of further changes in the state's energy regulations make CEO Marcus Wilhelm one of Triangle Business Journal's people to watch this year. If you spend a lot of time at Raleigh-Durham International Airport, Wilhelm is a person to watch in a very literal sense because a sighting could give you a big hint as to where Strata is planning its next big project. The company already has a small office in San Francisco and has built solar arrays atop several small commercial buildings in California. Business development manager Blair Schoof says the company is eyeing large projects in that state and in Virginia and in South Carolina. It already has launched into Tennessee with a couple of large solar farms for utilities there. "We're hoping this is the beginning of a long relationship with Tennessee," Schoof says. Wilhelm himself has been out of the state for most of the last 2 weeks and was unavailable for comment. In North Carolina, Strata accounted for more than half of the 225 megawatts of generating capacity that was scheduled to go online by the end of 2012. As of November, it had already registered more than 50 megawatts of the capacity scheduled to go online in 2013. The company's relatively large size is important in part because the industry has grown more competitive in the last year. Moreover, some skeptical legislators have warned that they could pare back regulation that has fostered the industry's growth at the expense of utility customers, those skeptics say. Passed in 2007, Senate Bill 3 set quotas for renewable energy use by electrical utilities at 12.5% by 2021. Representative Mike Hager, who chairs the North Carolina House Public Utilities Committee, says he is considering legislation that would freeze the quota at some level between the current 3% and the original targeted 12.5%. The North Carolina Utilities Commission, meanwhile, is poised to cut the so-called avoided cost rates that utilities have to pay to such independent power producers, another change that could take the solar wind out of the industry's sails. Last but not least, of the 10 people to watch in 2013, according to the Triangle Business Journal, Dr. Aldana Woos, North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. As the topics that will dominate headlines in 2013 begin to come into focus, it's clear that the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services will be at the center of much debate. It's unavoidable that the new secretary, Dr. Aldana Woos, will be one of the people to pay attention to this year. As the new head of an organization that receives in the neighborhood of $4.5 billion in state tax dollars, that's even more than the university system, Woos will no doubt see a Republican-controlled legislature and Governor's Manchin looking to trim funding for her department. Not only will she face budget pressures, but the state must set up some kind of system to expand Medicaid as well as an exchange for buying health insurance in order to become compliant with the Federal Affordable Care Act. On top of that, she will have to tackle mental health issues that are top of mind not only because of recent national headlines, but because many with developmental disabilities very nearly found themselves homeless. In late December, Governor Beverly Perdue transferred $1 million in emergency funding so that hundreds of people in groups' homes, many of them with developmental disabilities, would not lose funding. This is a topic that the legislature must address, of course, but the funds will be distributed through DHHS and could fall partly at the discretion of its secretary. It's a very tough job, says Adam Linker of the North Carolina Justice Center. Mental health and Medicaid will be her overwhelming focus, along with trying to balance budget cuts without harming the most vulnerable people in our state. On the budget side, Linker says calling for cuts is far easier than actually making them. Everyone thinks there's a huge amount of waste before they come, DHH secretary, and then they find out that you can't cut much before you start slashing services for seniors, children, and the disabled, she says. Woos is a medical doctor who is well-connected politically, having served as ambassador to Estonia during the George W. Bush administration. She was a fundraiser and campaign supporter of Pat McCrory. In 2011, the Washington Times reported that she is the daughter of a Polish soldier who fought against the Nazi invasion during World War II. She earned her medical degree from the Warsaw Medical Academy. Woos is also a member of the University of North Carolina System Board of Governors, where she makes funding decisions for the state's 17-member public university system. And that is the top 10 people to watch in 2013, according to the Triangle Business Journal. It'll be interesting to see what happens this year. Thank you. Continuing on with this week's news from the Triangle Business Journal, Grubb Plans Apartments on Downtown Raleigh Property by Amanda Jones Hoyle from Raleigh. Grubb Properties has grabbed the rights to build a 202-unit multifamily project in downtown Raleigh on a site where plans for an ambitious mixed-use hotel and office project were shelved. Grubb's Charlotte operation is negotiating to buy the 1.3-acre Powerhouse Plaza site at the corner of Jones and West Streets across from the 42nd Street Oyster Bar restaurant, according to site plans submitted to Raleigh's planning department. Powerhouse Plaza was approved as an 11-story hotel, office, and retail building that partners Cross Williams, Don Williams, and Gary Klein planned before the 2008 recession killed any hope of financing the project. I think it's a good plan, Klein says of Grubb's proposal. That site has been sitting empty, and we think apartments can yield the best return on our investment. It's one of the things that can still get financed. Klein says neither he nor the Williams family will be involved in the ownership of Grubb's building, but Klein's architecture firm is consulting with Grubb on the design of the building. The contemporary-style building, to be called Link at Glenwood South, will have two levels of structured parking underground, a large club facility, and a swimming pool. The nearly $30 million project will be part of the new line of urban apartment building projects that Grubb is launching across the southeast, says Grubb Properties President Scott Brown of Raleigh. The company hopes to break ground on the downtown Raleigh building in the second quarter of 2013. It's definitely more urban and a different product than our suburban apartment projects, Brown says. We're excited to be doing this project in Raleigh. Grubb opened its first Link-branded property in the Richmond, Virginia suburb of Manchester in November, he says, which has a more urban feel with smaller units compared to the company's Sterling-branded garden-style apartment communities typically built in suburban neighborhoods. Grubb opened its Sterling Town Center apartment community near Triangle Town Center Mall in North Raleigh in November. The Link at Glenwood South will open about a year after two other apartment projects in the Glenwood South District are scheduled to open, with a combined 384 new apartment units. The $21 million St. Mary's Square apartment community, located along the southern block bounded by St. Mary's, Johnson, and Gaston Streets, expects to begin leasing this year. The $35 million 425 Boylan Street project is slated to have 250 apartment units when it opens this year. Two other apartment projects are proposed in the Glenwood South District. The Gramercy Inn at 401 Glenwood Avenue is scheduled for a public hearing on a variance request in January, and another apartment project at 413 North Harrington Street is in the planning stages. This week's guest column is Mr. Willie Stewart. Mr. Stewart is the founder of Stewart Engineering in Raleigh. This article is entitled, Taking the Right Steps to Hire the Right People. For any business, there are countless decisions that must be made minute by minute, but one of the most vital choices that your company will make comes down to your employee makeup. Who exactly are you hiring to sit at the table? When taking into account the tangible and intangible costs of hiring the wrong employee for the job, the company expense is immense, easily ranging from $400,000 to $500,000, and that number can be expected to multiply depending on an individual's level of management and decision-making experience. Rarely do we consider the overall dollar amount that is attached to the hiring and firing process, but the expense can be detrimental to your staff, productivity, and your overall company growth. For companies to reach their highest level of success, investment must be made into a strategic and sophisticated recruiting process. Jack Welch stated at the 2012 North Carolina CEO Forum that the team that fields the best players wins. It's about hiring and firing, training and motivating young people, which then allows differentiation to happen. Developing the best team of employees must begin with the recruiting and hiring process. For effectiveness, the process should be conducted by the potential hire's immediate manager and must include a screening interview to determine if the individual holds the necessary skills and requirements. Before taking the candidate through a comprehensive interview, references from previous managers and coworkers must be thoroughly evaluated and confirmed, a process that is sometimes overlooked. By utilizing behavioral tools such as DISC, AVA, or Myers-Briggs, employers can better determine and match a person's natural behavioral tendencies with the necessary traits for the job that is being filled. For example, consider the traits needed for an engineer compared to those of a salesperson. While introverted, detail-oriented, and highly structured individuals may flourish as engineers, they would probably fall behind in the social and more sporadic role of a salesperson. But understanding your employee makeup cannot conclude with the initial recruitment phase. As the company looks to promote staff from within, behavioral assessments must be critically evaluated as well. Too often, individuals are promoted from a position in which they are highly productive to another that is a poor match. For example, when a highly skilled technical individual is made into a manager, it almost always requires a different skill set as well as a completely different personality. This usually means that someone who is an analytical, detail-oriented, and process-driven problem solver is promoted to a position that requires him or her to work with a greater company-wide focus, leading and motivating others, making quick decisions with limited information, meeting budget and delivery deadlines, and keeping customers satisfied. These roles require completely different personality traits. Additionally, beyond the hiring and promoting process, proper training is necessary for the highest level of employee performance. A study published recently in the Harvard Business Review confirmed the importance behind employee training, as the data demonstrated that young top performers, employees that organizations would like to retain most, are leaving their jobs in droves, mostly due to a lack of training opportunities in the workplace. With an increased focus on hiring and training, your company will be able to better retain and hire employees. Effective training leads to higher functioning and self-motivated employees who can self-manage, allowing employees and senior leaders to perform at a higher level, benefiting the overall performance of your entire company. With an emphasis on effective training, organizations can position themselves to become high-performing companies throughout the development of high-performing teams. More people continue to move into North Carolina than those who move out, says an annual study by United Van Lines. In fact, North Carolina was number 4 among the states and the District of Columbia in terms of in-migration, with 55% of total moves handled by the moving company being people moving here, as opposed to 45% moving from the Tar Heel State to elsewhere. North Carolina ranks behind D.C., Oregon, and Nevada, and just ahead of South Carolina. It's the 36th year for the study, and North Carolina has consistently been among the top inbound states. Also, NetApp is at the top, but this time it's not about its data storage, it's about the food. The company is listed third in a Great Place to Work, an ABC News list of the 9 coolest company cafeterias, with special recognition for its weekly Friday beer bashes at the Research Triangle Park campus. And it's not the only Triangle company recognized. Caribbean SAS netted 4th for its foodie perks, such as 1-acre sustainable farm that provides produce for the company cafeterias. And Ping Fu has released a book entitled Bend, Not Break. Fu, the CEO of 3D firm Geomagic, writes about her own history living through Mao's Cultural Revolution in China. She goes on to write about the experiences that led up to the founding of her company. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.